In the battle to retake Mosul from ISIS, Iraqi forces say they're making progress. But yesterday, they declared the city's municipal complex liberated. And moments later, suicide car bombs exploded. ISIS snipers opened fire from surrounding buildings on the now surrounded Iraqi convoys. It was a trap. This will seem familiar to Arwa Damon. In November, the CNN special international correspondent and her crew were embedded with Iraqi counterterrorism troops in a convoy of Humvees traveling on narrow, congested streets when a suicide car bomb took out the back Humvee. The front vehicle then went up in a massive ball of flames, and the Humvee Damon was in took a direct hit, the start of a 28-hour nightmare. Trapped under heavy ISIS fire, she and the Iraqi forces were taken in by some Iraqi families on the street. And finally, after reinforcements arrived, Damon and her cameraman, Brice Lene, were able to escape. It's now 2 months later, and they went back to find those soldiers and families. Arwa Damon joins us on Skype from Istanbul with what happened. Arwa, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you.
And before we hear your story, your thoughts on what just happened in the last couple of days in Mosul. Again, you know, declaring victory, but it turns out they were encircled and ambushed.
Which is unfortunately not surprising. They're a very unpredictable enemy. They're constantly morphing and changing. In the beginning of the battle for Mosul, for example, we saw them employing a lot of these suicide car bombs. Now they have drones that are loaded with explosives and small rockets. So it's an enemy that's constantly morphing. And it's also worth noting that it's an enemy that is much fiercer than anything the U.S., for example, faced during its occupation of Iraq.
Yeah. Well, and there might have been a strategic blunder, although this is so tricky. The Iraqi forces said that they were trying to go in quickly to this area so as not to alert the ISIS fighters they were there. But then in going in too quickly, they were then able to be surrounded. They didn't go house to house and get rid of the enemy before they went in. So it's just a real catch-22. But here you are going back after the convoy you were in with Iraqi forces was ambushed. Listen, you are a tough, great reporter, but we remember you were terrified. Is that safe to say when that happened?
Oh, absolutely. People always ask me how that experience changed me, and I say that my fear spectrum has been phenomenally enhanced. I also now know why sometimes people will believe something even if they know it's a complete lie, because you want to cling to that little shred of hope. Otherwise, your brain cannot necessarily handle what it is that you're actually going through.
Right. I mean, you almost didn't make it out. So why go back?
We went back for a number of reasons. First of all, there's the journalistic responsibility in going back. There's my personal attachment to Iraq, a country I've been reporting from since 2003. But in this case, what was really driving us, I think, was the more personal, profound need to go and find out what happened to the soldiers we were with, to the civilians, the families that sheltered us, because the last time we'd seen them, the last time we'd seen the soldiers, they were still in the midst of battle. The last time we saw one of the families, the last family we overnighted with, they were running out of their home barefoot in the middle of a hail of bullets.
Well, start with the soldiers. We remember scenes where, you know, they were completely under siege and they were still trying to fight back, running up and down stairs. That I remember that scene. And when you find them, one of them says to you, "We missed being under siege with you." They want to know about you and if you were okay. But how are they doing? Two months on, still fighting.
They are understandably exhausted, and they have this sort of dark humor that they use to cope with everything it is that they're going through, because at times that's really the only coping mechanism that you can have. A lot of the soldiers that we were with had been wounded. At the end, in the particular location we were in, we were with around 22 wounded soldiers and only 6 who were not. So a lot of them were actually out of the battlefield for about a month recovering from their injuries, but then they went back. They don't have the luxury of being able to leave or of having it end. This is their life day in, day out. And there's one soldier in particular, Staff Sergeant Ahmed. He had taken a bullet wound to the leg. He was the soldier you mentioned who was hopping down the stairs on one leg with his weapon. And he had actually also been the soldier who had treated my cameraman, Brice, when he had been wounded in the head. And he was telling us about how when he went back home to recover, his two-year-old daughter didn't recognize him because he'd been gone for so long. Mm. Bearing in mind, too, that these guys, they're also right now in the middle of that fight in Western Mosul. So on the one hand, they try to stay upbeat. They try to maintain a sense of humor. But it is exhausting, yeah, physically, mentally, emotionally.
But by the way, how is Brice, your cameraman, who was wounded?
He's very good. Yeah, good. He's excellent.
Good, good.
Yes.
Just want to make sure we check. You know. Okay, so the families. You were able to find the families who sheltered you when you were trapped. Here's some sound as you find the family that lived in the first house you found safety in back in November.
The homeowner's name is Naufal. And he thanks God.
What was that like, that reunion?
It was incredible. And I think the most incredible thing in all of it was the fact that they were worried about us. Nofal's wife, the last time I saw her and the kids, they were huddled in this tiny corner that was smaller than the trunk of a car. I barely spoke to them because they were so terrified. I just, you know, went over and said a few words. When I met his wife, she was trembling as she shook me and was covering me with kisses. And then she said to me, "We were so worried about you. I called my relatives in Baghdad and in Erbil to see if they'd found anything out about, you know, journalists who were trapped in Mosul." And I mean, I am still taken back by how it is that these people are so kind and generous that they were worried about us. I mean, it is truly a spectacular testimony to their humanity.
Well, and they are seeing some liberation in Mosul. Women don't have to wear black anymore. They're wearing some colors, you say. Men are shaving beards. They don't have to grow the long ones. ISIS required. Kids are going to school. You say, though, that teachers tell you that ISIS is forcing her to teach, and she's afraid that children might inadvertently be acting as spies. And obviously, we see that this, you know, the situation isn't over. We see what happened in the last couple of days. So how would you characterize how they are? Yeah, thrilled to see you, but we can't imagine there aren't tremendous mental health issues here.
Of course there are. And the teachers at the schools are very aware of this, and they are trying to provide the children with psychological support as best they can, trying to reassure the children that, you know, even though they were out of school, were not getting an education for about 2 years under ISIS, that those are not lost years, that it can be recouped. And Iraqis are very good at hiding their trauma, but you see it in their eyes. One of the little girls whose family we had sheltered with, her mother was telling us, and she was telling us that she still hears ISIS voices screaming at her, threatening to kill her. In some sense, you know, in the liberated parts of Mosul right now, people do perhaps feel as if they maybe might be on borrowed time. They know that this, relatively speaking, sense of security that they now have is not entirely guaranteed. They've been through this before.
Yeah. Well, and we should say that the threads that you pulled, not all of them ended with a good story. We remember a coalition airstrike on a house near the one you were sheltered in, and people in that house had been killed. ISIS insisted that they not leave, and they were killed. Just one of the experiences you've reported on. Look, we know you've started an organization called Inara, working to get kids in places like Mosul medical care they need. We'll link people up so they can find out more about that. But in the meantime, you know, we wanted to ask you what, you know, what the future of Mosul is. There's going to be a little girl named Arwa. A little baby was named after you. What do you think? What do you think's going to? What's end game here?
You know, I've been covering Iraq since 2003, and if there's one thing I know, it's not to try to predict the country's future. The only thing that we can really hope for right now is that its future will be kinder to its people than its past have been. We are only really beginning to scratch the surface of understanding what it is that this population has gone through. And yes, as you keep saying, it's not over.
Arwa Damon, CNN special international correspondent. We'll link you to all her reporting on her return to Mosul at herenow.org. Arwa, thanks, and as always, stay safe.
My pleasure. Thank you.